Today's Teisho will be on case 47 in the Mumon Khan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 47 is entitled Tosatsu's Three Barriers. Tosatsu Etsu Osho set up three barriers for his disciples. One, you leave no stone unturned to explore profundity, simply to see into your true nature. Now I want to ask you, just at this moment, where is your true nature? Two, if you realize your true nature, you are free from birth and death. Tell me, when your eyesight deserts you at the last moment, how can you be free from birth and death? Three, when you set yourself free from birth and death, you should know your ultimate destination. So when the four elements separate, where will you go? Mumon's comment. If you can put turning words to these three questions, you are the master wherever you may stand and command Zen, whatever circumstances you may be in. If otherwise, listen. Gulping down your meal will fill you easily, but chewing it well can sustain you. Mumon's verse. This moment's thought sees through eternal time. Eternal time is just this moment's thought. If you see through this moment's thought, you see through the person who sees through this moment. I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning. You had to get up on a Saturday, maybe after a very busy week of work. You were probably a little tired, but you got up and you came here to practice Zen. So, thank you. In this koan, Tosatsu said to his students, "You leave no stone unturned to explore profundity, simply to see into your true nature." Well, I actually think that describes people here. You know, he doesn't say you had to set your alarm clock early and get up and drive over here, but I think that's what he means. People who practice Zen like this are kind of, unusual people. At some point in your life, you might have an experience that just turns everything around for you, and you no longer can believe in the stories you used to tell yourself, you know? Or it might happen like this, you know, little by little, people begin to realize that the way they have been taught to see the world might not actually be real. You know? So when we're growing up, we believe everything we learn, pretty much. You know, our teachers tell us things, our parents tell us things. But little by little, experiences in life may begin to sort of quietly fill us with some kind of doubt. And at some point, you know, it might not be at any one moment, but at some point, you know, you're just a different person. And then you feel this desire to know, you know, to know. Some people, that desire to know, you know, sends people in many different directions. You know, sometimes it sends them into the library, and they read lots of books. And sometimes it sends them into, say, traditional religion, where you want to find a belief system that you can really hold on to, that you can internalize, and put these doubts to rest. Put these doubts to rest. This doesn't happen to everybody. Some people have a deep desire to be happy, which is a good thing. And they have a deep desire to belong, right? To be part of a community. So not everybody has, I think, this burning desire to know. I want to push the curtains aside and see what's behind the curtain, some people maybe don't have that need. They don't have that need. And, I'm not putting anybody down if they decide that Zen is not their cup of tea. There are many paths in life. But I've known some of the kindest people in the world who don't meditate, who don't read philosophy. And I've known people who meditate who aren't so nice, and I've known people who study philosophy who are not so wise, But I think there's something important about this experience that happens to some people, where, you just wake up one day and you say, I'm not happy with what I've been told, and I want to find out what's real in my own flesh and bones, in my own, I want to know it in my bones. I want to know it in every atom of my being. And, some people go into the library, and some people look for traditional religious belief. And then there are people, I think, who get interested in Zen, people who get interested in Zen. And our way is really different, I think. We practice Zazen, and our approach is to enter a state, you could say, of like alternative consciousness, where if you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, at some point you stop orienting yourself to orienting your attention to the self. Ordinary consciousness is really self-centered, not in a selfish way, but it's constantly going out into the world and coming back to the self, and out into the world and coming back to the self. This is like ordinary consciousness. All day long we go out and then we come back. And when we come back, it's like, oh yes, I'm Kurt, check, got it, back out, back to Kurt, back out, So this is sort of like ordinary consciousness. There's nothing wrong with this. We all have a self. We all need a self. But the Zen approach is that the Zen discovery. The Zen discovery is that if you sit very, very still and very, very quietly, and you focus on any object of attention, but the breath works very well, you'll discover that your consciousness is no longer anchored in yourself. It begins to open up, and it becomes sort of like decentered. When you're in deep samadhi, things around you are more fully part of yourself, or you can experience things around you as though they're part of yourself, whereas the self, which we usually think of as the center of our experience, sort of disappears. So when you're in deep samadhi, you're in this state where self is not so strongly present, and you begin to feel connected to things around you. And the Zen approach is to begin to explore reality by immersing ourselves very deeply in this state. And the Zen view is that actually you don't need to study sutras. You don't need to read philosophy. But what you do need to do is be able to spend a lot of time in this state and observe the world around you very, very carefully, very, very intently. And all of Zen training, it really involves doing that. Learning how to get into samadhi, that state of decentered awareness, and then get there very, very deeply. And then observe the world around you. So, you know, something like a Saturday sit is about getting very, very deeply into samadhi. You know, and probably by the end of but probably somewhere around your third sit today or your second sit, you probably felt a change in your concentration. You probably felt your concentration change, and you, everything feels differently. You know, for me, samadhi feels a little bit like jumping into the deep end of a pool. If you jump into the deep end of the pool and you go down into the deep end, you feel that pressure around you. That I when I'm in deep samadhi, I sort of feel like I'm surrounded by something or I'm in something. My mind is very still and very few thoughts are arising. This is like very highly praised, prized state, very important state in Zen practice. And the more you sit, the easier it is to get into samadhi, even though it can be frustrating. You know, sometimes you sit down, you can't get into samadhi. And then sometimes you'll sit down and you're right in it. You're deeply in it. You're right in the deep end of the pool, you know. But getting to that place is sort of like stage one of Zen practice. And then all of the koans that we do, all the practice beyond that, is about overcoming our assumptions and our inner obstacles and experiencing the world as it really is. So it involves sort of like cutting through our illusions and then encountering things as they really are. And this is quite difficult, actually. But the Zen view is you can find all the answers through this process. This is the Zen view. The Zen view is that if you can just observe the world around you, you can solve like any problem you might want to pose. Now, I guess you can't find a cure for cancer by just getting into Zazen and being in deep samadhi. But it's probably the case that if you are in a very open and receptive state and you're paying a lot of attention, you will notice all kinds of things you might not notice otherwise. And the kind of questions that Zen is most concerned about are not necessarily questions like what causes cavities or, you know, how do I, where should I invest my retirement income? It's more like questions like, you know, what does it mean to be alive? Who am I? Where am I going? You know, and what's going to happen to me? You know, those are questions I think that this process is very well equipped to answer. And so, you know, the Zen view is that any kind of question that you have about life or about yourself, or about things that happen to you, the kind of questions that would come out of your heart, let's say, can be answered on the cushion, in the moment. That's the Zen view. You know, so this koan is actually partly about life and death. So, question two, Tosatsu's second barrier is, if you realize your true nature, you are at last free from life and death. Tell me, when your eyesight deserts you at the last moment, how can you be free from birth and death? Now, in other words, this is really pointing to something quite important, you know, which is, You're here for a little while. You're on this earth for a little while. And then something is going to happen to you. You know, something is really going to happen to you at the end of this process. And what is it? And how are you going to deal with that? You know. So this koan is sort of pointing to something very, very important. You know, I am in the last, hopefully the last the quarter or maybe even third of my life. And, you know, you have to think about it. You know, I had a friend just recently who was only a few years older than I am who passed away. And this year my teacher passed away. And you know, when you're young, you don't think that, say, the death is a big deal. You don't think death is a big deal. But, you know, actually, I think under the surface, we're all sort of thinking about the fact that our lives are finite. You know, we're all wondering how we can use, how can we really live while we're here? And even though when we're young, it seems that time, you know, sometimes when you're young, time just seems to stretch out interminably. So, you know, you might just look ahead and think, oh my gosh, years and years, you know, what am I going to do? But from the other end of the process, you know, when you look back, it all goes right like this, very fast. You know, in the Diamond Sutra, at the end of the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha says, you know, at the end of your life, when you look back at it, it's going to be like a flash of lightning. You know how lightning flashes and it illuminates everything and then it's over. It's going to seem like that, very fast, very, very quiet. And even though when you're young it seems to stretch on forever, I still think, you know, I still think that we're all a little bit, we can even if we're young, we can see it coming. And I think all kinds of anxieties are produced by realizing, you know, that we have limited time. This is the, you know, as far as we know, this is the only life we're going to live. And, you know, it's like there's an hourglass on the table and the sand is running out. So how are we going, what are we going to do with our lives? Some of you may know that in Buddhist tradition, there's a belief in many Buddhists believe in rebirth or reincarnation. You know, and this is a big. For Western people, this is like a big problem, right? You know, in some ways, Buddhism seems so scientific. You know, lots of people who are involved in Buddhism are doing brain research, you know? And they've studied the brains of meditators, and, you know, it turns out that meditation really changes your brain, how it processes information. In fact, a friend of mine just sent me a videotape on. I get these all the time from people. It's about how the brain is changed by meditation, and they're fascinating. You know, and Buddhism is very scientific, very up to date, physicists are very interested in Buddhism. One of our members, who doesn't usually come on Saturday, is a physicist here at Rutgers. And he talks to me sometime about physics and meditation practice, and he sees lots of connections between them. Buddhism can seem very scientific and very very empirical, but there's this other thing, reincarnation, which is a little bit embarrassing, right? Because, you know, there's no scientific evidence for this. You know, so most people I know who are Buddhists don't even want to talk about it. You know, we don't think about that. And there have been some big debates in American Buddhism. About 10 years ago, there was a big debate between a man named Stephen Batchelor, who's written some wonderful books on Buddhism, on Zen, and he calls himself a Buddhist atheist. And so Stephen Batchelor doesn't think reincarnation is a serious belief. And he's embarrassed by it, and he wants Buddhism to be modern. And then he was debating with a man named Robert Thurman, some of you may know, who's a Tibetan scholar. And Thurman was, he was kind of upset about this dismissal of reincarnation. He felt, you know, lots of, you know, in the Tibetan tradition, they take this very seriously. And when a Dalai Lama dies, you know, they have an actual, in the Tibetan tradition, they actually have a, like a seer or an oracle. They have a state oracle, yeah? And the state oracle goes into a trance, and in his trance state, he can predict where the next Dalai Lama is likely to be born. After the death of the, I guess, the 13th Dalai Lama, the one before our current Dalai Lama, the state oracle went into a trance, and he predicted where they should look for the rebirth of the previous Dalai Lama. And they sent a secret entourage to this country home of this farmer, this sort of a peasant family. And they brought objects from the previous Dalai Lama and mixed them up with objects that didn't belong to the previous Dalai Lama. And the current Dalai Lama apparently picked the right objects. When I first got interested in Buddhism, these stories were just fascinating to me. You know, I just thought, that is so cool. You know, imagine that. You know, and I don't know. You know, maybe it is true. Maybe it is true. You know, it would be nice, actually. You know, if that happened. And you know, the Tibetans believe in this so ardently. They're so committed to this. Their whole system is based on this. Thurman was arguing with Batchelor, and Batchelor was saying, "Come on, reincarnation, give me a break," you know. And Thurman was saying, "Well, wait, you know, all of this evidence, you know, blah blah blah." And you know, I got my alumni magazine the other day. I was an undergraduate at the University of Virginia, where my father lived, and I had residency. I got the UVA magazine, and on the cover story was about rebirth. And there's a bunch of scientists in the psychiatry department at the medical school at the University of Virginia who do all these studies. They go and visit children who say they've had past lives, and they record the data, and then they try to see if there's any validity. And they have thousands of these cases, right? So anyway, you know, if you practice Buddhism, you know, you might be thrilled by all of this, and it is very, very cool. And if it turns out consciousness migrates from one life to another, that will be quite an interesting universe, you know. On the other hand, there's a lot of people who are embarrassed by this, and they want to be modern, and they want to be scientific, and this makes them very uncomfortable because it seems like a relic of the ancient past. You know? But, you know, maybe all of these people are, you know, in some ways they kind of miss the point, I think, about reincarnation. You know, they miss the point, maybe. Because, you know, reincarnation might be literally true, or not, you know, but there's something there that's valuable no matter what. You know, it might just be like a symbol, or it might be a way of understanding a reality that's very deep, even if it's not literally true, you know. And by the way, you know, I myself have never had any recollections of past lives in all. I've been doing this for 35 years, and I have never had a past life recollection or anything like that. So I hope you'll come back next Saturday after I've told you that. But I haven't, and nobody I know has either, as a matter of fact. And I know people who are very deeply awake, I would say. So anyway, it might just be a primitive relic of the past, and it might make us feel better, as death gets closer and closer, at least knowing we'll have another shot is a nice idea. But there might be a deep truth here anyway, whether we're reborn or not, a deep truth to this teaching. What's the deep truth? Okay, well, last night somebody came to sit who has not been sitting for a while. She's been sitting with our group for a number of years. She doesn't come on Saturday, but she's pretty regular. At least once a week she comes to sit. And she is a psychologist who works with women who have suffered from domestic violence. And so she has a very stressful and difficult life because she sees, people who are suffering a lot, and she also sees like the very, sometimes the worst aspects of human nature, Anyway, she has been very faithfully coming here for years, at least once a week, and she says it really helps her deal with her own distress, her own emotional distress, But she went back to India for 4 months, and she didn't do any meditation at all. This is fascinating to me, and it's a subject of another Taisho sometime. Is when people are sitting and they get so much benefit, why don't they do it more? It's fascinating. It's very important. It's not a simple question. It's difficult to face your true nature. To come in here and sit down on the cushion and deal with your physical discomfort, that's difficult. But even more difficult is facing the emptiness inside yourself, even if it's liberating and even if it makes you feel great. So more on that some other time. But it's not trivial. It's extremely important. But anyway, she had stopped sitting. She stopped sitting, and she decided when she was back, she'd come back, and she really wants to get back into it. So I was so happy to see her, and at the end of this meditation period, I went up and I said, "How was your sit?" And I was hoping she was going to go, "Fantastic! I'm so glad to be back." And she said, "That was terrible." I said, "Why?" She said, "I'm so out of practice." And I said, "Was it your physical discomfort?" She said, "No." She said, "I just kept feeling like I had to get up and check my phone for messages." See, isn't that fascinating? See, and she said, "I can't, when I'm not checking my email or my phone, I feel anxiety." This is really interesting, And she said, "All the time I feel like I've got to check, I've got to check, I've got to check." And she, I guess what she had been doing in India involved like being constantly plugged in. So to sit down on a cushion and not check her mail actually made her anxiety level go through the ceiling. That's interesting, right? But I think that's quite common, quite common. This is our culture today, I would say, the plugged-in society. It a long time ago, before some of you were even born, there was no internet, believe it or not, and there was something called a telephone. There was a wire that went into the wall, and there was a dial, and you actually twisted the dial, and you twisted the dial, and this actually was the case. For a number of years, I didn't own a phone, So when I was a graduate student, I didn't own a phone. When I needed to make a call, I went to what was called a public phone, and I would make a call, and I would put money in a little slot, and I could call, and then I could go back to it. So when I was in my home, I was by myself, and nobody could bother me if I didn't want to be bothered, So nobody could get in touch with me. They could send me a letter, or they could see me at school, And it was a wonderful life, actually, So now they can get in touch with you 24/7. I understand that some we've all had jobs where we have to stand around. I used to work as a cook in a restaurant, and sometimes there's nothing going on, right? You know, you're waiting for customers, and everything's done. You're sort of wiping the table, staring at the ceiling. If you work in retail, you know, sometimes you're just sitting there waiting for a customer. You know, you might wait all day and no customers come in. You know, this happens. Well, now these companies have a system where you stay at home, and if suddenly customers come in, they can get in touch with you, and you have to come in to work. But you're not being paid for standing around anymore. You're only being paid for when you're at work. This is a terrible system. Not only because you're not being paid, but because look at what it does to your life. It means you're constantly at somebody's beck and call, and you're constantly anxious that you're going to... So you can't really relax, you know, and get into something, because your boss might call in any minute now. You have to put your shoes on and rush out to serve somebody a cup of espresso. So this is the world we live in, and this is an extension of a culture that's been developing for a long time. You know, I would say that our culture is terrifically future-oriented, right? I mean, we live for the future. This is our culture. These are our values. Not everybody lives this way, but our culture is hugely future-directed. It's always about tomorrow, always about tomorrow. And this is so much part of our culture that we absolutely take it for granted. We think it's natural and normal, but it's totally artificial. And I would say very unhealthy. You know, This idea that the future holds the key to our happiness, has many aspects. It has to do with the way we organize our business. It has to do with our economy. But you know, it also has to do with ancient traditions in the West. You know, this idea that time is a line and it starts in the beginning. There's a beginning and an end to time, right? And we're all moving forward from the beginning to the end, and our redemption or our deliverance or our final heaven, lies in the future. And so we're constantly getting ready for heaven, and it's up ahead in the future. And if we just keep moving forward, we're going to get there finally. You know, so this is a deep structure to the way we live our lives. It affects not just our religious values, but it affects every aspect. You know, Ronald Reagan said America is the only country that lives in the future, and he's right. He was wrong about everything else, but he was right about that. You know. And it affects. It's produced a world where you can be called to work at any moment, and you're constantly. You sit down on the cushion, and you're afraid you might be missing an important message. Who knows from whom? You know, and I myself feel the power of this force. You know, I too have an internet, and I too have emails, and I'll be working on something, and I'll think maybe I should check my emails. There might be an important announcement. You know, or something from. And I'll go and there's just a bunch of spam, or something trivial, and you can spend hours just fooling around with your email. So, I would say that Zen and Buddhism have a very different orientation, very different orientation. One of the things about reincarnation is that you're just going to be back here again and again, see? This is a very important lesson. You know, there's a very famous Buddhist poem, and its name escapes me right now. I'm so sorry, but it's a very famous Buddhist poem, and it's about it was composed by a very great Indian meditation master. But it starts out with the gods in heaven, in Tushita heaven. And basically, the gods, this particular god realizes his time is running out in heaven, and now he's going to be reborn on earth. So he says, even the gods in heaven can't stay here forever. Our merit or our good karma runs out, as all karma does. It runs out, and then we get reincarnated in a lower form as a human. So, you know, if you're a god in heaven, in Tushita heaven, you know, if you think, I'd like some grapes, boom, grapes, right there, right? You think, a cooling breeze would be nice, and then your face is fanned by a cooling breeze. See, this is what it means to be in Tushita heaven. But, you know, on earth, if you say, I'd like some grapes, they don't just appear in your hand, you know? If you say, boy, it's hot in here, the universe doesn't change the temperature for you. So being a human is harder than being a god, yeah? This is the implication. And the implication is that, nobody can escape from change. And basically, you're always going to come back, you know? So one way to think about the Buddhist teaching of reincarnation is that you're going to go through all these lives and finally, you're going to get out. You're going to get out. And you'll be in Tushita heaven, let's say. But actually, this poem says, nope, even if you get into Tushita heaven, you can't stay. And you have to come back to earth. And so even like the happiest moments are temporary, you know. So, you know, early Buddhists believed that the goal of meditation practice is to get out. So basically, you're going to live this life and this life and this life and this life, and if you live a good life and you do a lot of meditation and you have an enlightenment experience, you'll finally be what they called a non-returner. You know, there a non-returner sounds like a bottle, doesn't it? You know, that's a returner, and the returners go in that pile and the non-returners go in this pile. But a non-returner is somebody who's eliminated all karma and now is going to return to the source, this perfection. And have no longer any kind of a personal self, be unified with the universe. That was the early Buddhist view, but the Mahayana view is very different from that. See, the Mahayana view said, actually, a rebirth is unstoppable. And basically, in fact, if you were a good person, you wouldn't want to go to Tushita heaven until everybody else gets in. See, this is the Buddhist, this is actually the Zen view. If somebody said to you, okay, Bill, you're out. Good, congratulations. You know, this is a madhouse and now you can go to a better place. And think about it. If you said, oh, great, I'm finally out of here, what would that say about you? See, so the Mahayana view is, wait a minute, a good person wouldn't take that deal. A good person would turn around and look at all those other people suffering and say, hey, I'm not going anywhere until they're going. So you know, the Mahayana was like a revolution in Buddhism because it said there is no such thing as individual liberation. We're all in this together. And also, if you can be fully in the moment, in an awakened mind, it is already nirvana. It is already nirvana. So it's, nirvana is not like somewhere at the end of time, and it's not on another planet. It's right here, if you can just liberate yourself from your illusions. See? So basically, in one sense, you know, the message of something like reincarnation is, the original message was, you go through these lives and finally you can get out. But the Mahayana view is, look, you go through this life and you go through this life and you're going to have another life and you're not going to have another life, so you might as well try to figure out how to be here now in the best possible way, because there is no escape. There is no escape. Now, the idea that there's no escape could be very depressing, you know, if you can't get out of a hellish mind. But the Mahayana view is, look, You can get out. You can get out. You can do it. You know. So the Mahayana view is, okay, you're in a minute you don't like, and you think the next minute will be better, but you get there and it's pretty much another minute you don't like. So the solution is not to keep looking forward for a better moment in the future. The solution is to figure out how to be here now in the best possible way. See? That if you're unhappy now, it's very unlikely, actually, that the next moment will be happier. Actually, the Buddhist view is you're bringing your unhappiness with you from moment to moment. So the real problem isn't to get to a better moment. The real problem is how you're dealing with this moment. See? We Western people, we modern people, we live for the future. But you know, when we get to the future, it's just another screwed up place. This future orientation is very escapist and actually robs us of the chance to figure out how to be here fully in the most intelligent way, the most alert and alive way. So Zazen is all about being here fully, 100%, without judgment. And this is heaven. This is heaven. You know, last night, this woman was telling me about, like she said, I actually almost had an anxiety attack on the cushion. She said, because I've been so stressed, and there have been these constant demands on me, and I feel like I have to be texting or I have to be online all the time. And when I suddenly cut that off, I almost had an anxiety attack. And I think this is quite common. Even before there was an internet, we had this mentality, which is why we created the internet. The future holds the key to our liberation, see. But actually, if we can just sit down and be with the moment, be still with the moment, everything. You know, she was describing her sit, and it was samsara. Samsara. Do you know that word? It's like the Buddhist version of misery. Right? So you know, she sat down on the cushion, and all of this, these habits, these mental habits, are making it impossible for her to be in the moment in a calm, present way. And people even feel guilty if they're in the moment. They even feel guilty. Right, I should be connecting right now, right? Or they feel another thing that people often feel is they feel lonely in the moment because they're not connected, or they feel left out somehow because all this fun is being had online. However, by the way, do you know that the more you go to Facebook, the more likely you are to be depressed. That's not my crackpot idea. There's a lot of research to suggest that's true. There's a relationship between people who spend lots of time on Facebook and depression. So anyway, meditation. You turn off the phone. You turn off the radio. You're sitting in the moment, and then, you know, if you have all these mental habits, you might feel like you're going to jump out of your skin. But if you keep watching the breath, you know, you're going to get to a place where those anxieties become less pressing, and you have glimpses of a kind of sanity. Being in the moment, you know, is actually true. You know, someday, if we have a future, you know, someday people are going to look at us and just scratch their heads. They're going to say, did they really live that way? Did they really believe that? You know, if you practice meditation for, say, a couple years, 3 or 4 years, and you sit down on the cushion, maybe it won't even take 3 or 4 years, you'll have an experience like, you'll just feel like everything around you has just come to life. It's like you sit in, when you're in samadhi, you feel like everything around you is alive. Now, I actually think this is real. This is actually how things are. You know, you feel like this, everything, you're surrounded by life. Everything seems alive. I mean, even trees seem alive, or grass seems alive. You know, and even though it sounds crazy, even like your pencils seem alive. You know, and I think that when we live for the future, it has the effect of deadening everything. It makes everything in the present seem dead or gray or inconsequential. But you know, when you are in the present 100%, everything becomes very lively, very lively. There are many people on Earth, or there used to be anyway, who actually believed that everything was alive. You know, I was just reading this interview with this woman in Siberia, and she was talking about, you know, it was like an anthropological study, and she was talking about the way she looked at the world, and she said, you know, we think the Earth is alive. You know, we think it's our mother's body, and so on. And we Western people might think, well, that's just a metaphor, or she can't be serious, right? But I think her world of experience, in her world of experience, this is self-evident and it's real. So Zen is really about a different way of life, a different way of experiencing time and consciousness. And when we anchor ourselves in the moment, everything comes to life. And also, you know, actually, if you're in really deep samadhi sometimes, the time itself disappears. Now, one thing that happens to people who do a lot of meditation is at some point you just realize you can be in a moment that just feels absolutely timeless. And I don't think that's an illusion. You know, my physicist friend tells me that the physics people don't necessarily believe in time at all. They think the universe is already done, actually, and we're just moving from one slice of the bread, of the loaf of bread, to the next. But the whole loaf has already been baked, you know. So we experience the world as though there were time. But actually, you know, sometimes when we're on the cushion, we experience the world as though there is no time. You know, this is absolutely something every human being who meditates has experienced. Being in the moment is really a liberation from the Buddhist standpoint. And it might not be the moment you expected, and it might not be the moment you want. But if you are imagining that a better moment up ahead will be better than this one, another moment up ahead will be better than this one, that is the essence of samsara from the Zen point of view. And so the path of liberation is always trying to be one with whatever is happening. And that requires a mind that's grounded in samadhi. And if you can be in that mind, you know, you will if you haven't already, you know, samadhi is relaxing, it's calm, you feel balanced and centered, but at some point you'll have this experience where everything comes alive. In a way, as soon as you start wishing for the future, it all disappears. You know, the life drains out and you're now in an empty present. So being in the moment is quite important. Tosatsu's three barriers. Tosatsu Etsu Osho set up three barriers for his disciples. One, you leave no stone unturned to explore profundity, simply to see into your true nature. Now I want to ask you, just at this moment, what is your true nature? Where is your true nature? Two, if you realize your true nature, you are free from birth and death. Tell me, when your eyesight deserts you at the very last moment, how can you be free from birth and death? 3, when you set yourself free from birth and death, you should know your ultimate destination. So when the four elements separate, where will you go? You could say, I'll go to heaven. You could say, I'll be reincarnated in Tibet, and I'll be discovered by monks from Sera Monastery. You could say, I will be a dog. You could say, but the answer, just for the record, is I will be right here. Okay. Mumon's comment. If you can put turning words to these three questions, you will be the master wherever you stand and command Zen whatever circumstances you may be in. If that's not the case, listen. Gulping down your meal will fill you. Rushing on to the next meal will fill you, but chewing it will sustain you. Mumon's verse. This moment's thought sees through eternal time. Eternal time is just this moment. If you see through this moment's thought, you see through the illusion who sees this moment.